Oh, I'm sorry. Did you guys think that you already had your cult podcast for this week? Then y'all must have forgot that you're listening to this on November 12th, which is my birthday, but also the birthday of another cult leader that we need to talk about. So this is going to start our four-part series about my birthday twin and one of the most famous cult leaders of all time. We're covering the Manson family. So, thank you for tuning into Cult Podcast. I'm Paige Wesley.
And I'm Charles Manson.
Finally putting it to you.
Getting it in good and early.
Yeah.
You know what they say, the early bird loses his mind on acid in the California desert.
That's pretty much what happens, yeah.
Fuck, it hurts so much.
And he talked like that for 80 years.
Oh, and I'm Armando Torres.
And with us we've got
Andrea Gazzetta.
Yay!
Who is very scared.
Armando's hair looks like Charles Manson right now.
Yeah, you're looking a little Manson-y. Although I've got a picture of young Manson.
What the fuck?
I know, not a bad looking dude.
Handsome
I
mean, man. No, if you take away the terrifying serial killer smile, his like from the nose up, he looks like a Boy Scout going to church. From the nose down, he looks like he's already murdered so many people.
I mean,
that's what we call a butcher face. It's like a, it's like a butter face, but you murder people.
So we'll have a number of sources throughout pretty much all the four different episodes because there's different sources for different parts of the life of this cult and the life of Charles Manson. We've also got a special guest coming in for some later episodes as well. But for the episode we're looking at today, our main sources are going to be Manson in his own words, as told to Newell Emmons. So then we've got Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi with Kurt Gentry. Vincent Bugliosi was the prosecuting attorney for the eventual trial. And then we've also got The Life and Times of Charles Manson by Jeff Gein. So both Manson in his own words and Helter Skelter were written over 30 years ago, closer to the time of when the crimes occurred. And they represent essentially two sides of the same story. You've got Manson, who is insane, telling his own life story. But then you've also got Vincent Bugliosi, who his story has to kind of match up with the narrative that the state created for their cases, which is not necessarily correct. They both have kind of a biased interest in their own in the story they're telling.
Yeah.
So the truth is somewhere in the middle. Life and Times of Charles Manson by Jeff Gein, G-U-I-N-N. This is written in 2013, where they had access to some things that we didn't have access to in the 70s, like automated birth records, death records, marriage certificates, a lot of different things that he was able to find that other people didn't. He's also the guy that wrote one of the most recent books on Jonestown that's actually really good as well. And he essentially combines a lot of what's in Manson in his own words and what's in Helter Skelter in that book. He kind of pulls from both to try and kind of find the truth in the middle. So I would say if you're only buying one book on Charles Manson and the Manson family instead of the six that I now own, go with that one.
We just spent 3 weeks dealing with Sun Myung Moon in his own words. So yeah. I can attest to how fucking hog wild it gets when somebody tries to explain their own life and they're just a pathological lying piece of shit.
Oh, I would say if you want a fun read, go for Manson in his own words.
Oh yeah, for sure.
That's definitely the most fun. So if you're wondering why Pottering on It hasn't come out, we've got multiple episodes not edited because Paige was reading about Charles Manson.
Fair.
They'll come out eventually. This was more important. So to understand the Manson family and how it came to be and how it became the behemoth that it became as far as cult history, we have to understand Charles Manson and where he came from.
So it's my understanding is when a Papa Manson and a Mama Manson hate each other very much.
They give butt baby birth to Charles Manson.
You never heard about the Hellbirds and the Devil Bees?
give birth to a little spider brain baby.
Oh my god.
Alright, so let's get started with Charles Manson's grandparents. So Charles Manson's grandparents were named Nancy and Charles Maddox. They lived in Ashland, Kentucky. Nancy was a stay-at-home mom, and Charles worked for the railroad. And this is the early 1900s. They were married fairly young. They had four children. Most of their children they had from, like, 1911 to 1918. So that's kind of the timeline we're looking at.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Despite living through the Great Depression, everyone still used the railroad. So Charles Maddox's job was relatively recession-proof. They managed to stay kind of a comfortable middle-class family. By all accounts, they were pretty happy. Their four children were Glenna, Eileen, Luther, and Ada Kathleen, who generally went by Kathleen. Following their move from Ashland to kind of deeper into Kentucky to follow his railway job, they moved about 60 miles away.
They moved, I thought you were going to say they moved 60 miles an hour.
Yeah. like the train. Yeah. he took his job to heart. So following the move, Charlie Maddox caught what he thought was a chest cold, and he was dead within a week.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
They don't really know what it is. It may have been pneumonia. Who knows?
That is the exact opposite of me anytime I get sick, where I'm like, I've caught my death in a week. And the doctor's like, it's a cold. Calm down.
Well, that's Jake has had a cold for 2 weeks now, going on 2.5. And he constantly sounds like he's dying and then has still gone to work every day, despite me telling him not to.
What a real man. I know. There was one day where I woke up 45 minutes late and I was like, well, guess this counts as sick.
So Nancy was a fiercely devout Christian, bordering on fundamentalism. She was specifically Nazarene, which if I don't know if we've talked about Nazarene Christianity very much yet. Women were considered subservient, long sleeves, long hair, because you're not supposed to cut your hair. It's your glory. You're also not supposed to braid it. And no makeup. Or very little makeup. Mm-hmm. Long dresses as well. But in their town, wildly common. Almost everyone in their town was of a similar faith and a similar level of conservative belief. So they fit right in. She believed that she should stay home and continue to raise the children even after her husband's death. And thankfully, his pension from the railroad company actually allowed her to do that.
Wow.
She received $60 a month, which it's amazing that you could raise a family of four on $60 a month back then. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if you could feed a family of four for $60 right now.
You would be hard pressed.
A day. $60 a day.
Yeah. Well, and they bought their house cash for $5,000. Like, I would kill.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be amazing. So their oldest daughter, Glenna, got married and moved out of the house and almost immediately had a daughter named Joanne. Joanne will come into play a little bit later. Her marriage was kind of trouble from the start. Her daughter was often left with Nancy to avoid her parents fighting. This becomes kind of a theme where Nancy ends up caring for a lot of her children's children. Eventually, Glenna and her husband divorced, and then Glenna and her daughter moved back into the house with Nancy. Nancy didn't believe in divorce and was extremely upset, but still allowed them to come back to the house. Their middle child, Eileen, right around the same time, went to business college and graduated with the intent to become a secretary. But then suddenly she caught a chest cold.
Oh, no.
And she was dead within a week.
Oh, no.
What?
Nancy was devastated.
This is some suspicious-ass chest cold.
She was miles away. But within a year, her husband and one of her daughters was dead, and another daughter was divorced.
If I was going to make a TV show of this, it would be a reality show, and it'd be called Baby Mama Dramas.
So all of this, understandably, had drawn Nancy's attention away from her youngest two children, Luther and Kathleen, who were now teenagers, and had kind of started to bristle under her conservative ways. So Kathleen loved to dance, even though it was completely forbidden by the Nazarene faith.
Aww. What kind of footloose-ass Jesus is this?
This is actually... So I went to Christian school all the way through high school, and our high school was not allowed to have dances, not because I went to a Nazarene high school, but because we were an interdenominational high school, which meant that we might have Nazarene students, and so in order to not offend everybody, we didn't have dances.
What?
Yeah. We had banquets, or I went to public school dances with some of my friends, but...
That, to me, is just... That sounds insane.
I mean, it's kind of like now when they're like, hey, don't bring anything with peanut butter into a school because of the kids with allergies.
Yeah, except if I went like, skibbity-boppity-boo, Tyler over there wouldn't be like, oh no, my weakness! And then die.
Most of me.
Oh my God, he's doing the Dougie. Somebody get my EpiPen.
Is he jabbing? It's contagious.
So Kathleen was described as not very pretty, but with a great personality.
Oh, for 1918 standards?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
this
no.
That's rough. This is now after the Depression. So this is like late 1920s.
Jeez.
Early 1930s. Right.
We've all seen those kids, though.
Yeah. It's okay. She desperately wanted to dance and wanted to go out dancing, but everyone...
What is with everyone needing to dance?
I know. Moon, now Kathleen. Yeah.
Are you telling me that she abandons her family?
We'll get to it.
To dance?
I guess technically she could dance if she wanted to. She can leave her family behind. Because if her family don't dance, and if they don't dance, then they're no family of mine. I'm pretty sure this is the third time?
The second, at least.
I fucking love the safety dance.
So their town was very close-knit and very small, and everyone knew everyone. And so Kathleen knew that she couldn't dance in their small town because it would get back to her mom, and then she'd be in trouble.
I can't dance in this small town.
Oh my God.
It is literally footloose. She had to go outside the town. She would cross a local bridge into Ironton, Ohio, to dance, and it was on one of these trips that she met a man named Colonel Scott. Colonel was a nickname.
Oh, no shit.
He wasn't actually a colonel. And he and his brother were con men. They conned us all into thinking their fried chicken was good. And then now we're stuck with it.
There we go.
Don't fuck with the gravy. I'm just kidding. It wasn't that colonel. That would have been a way better story. One of the grifts they had pulled off was locally there was a private bridge owned by like a rich landowner, mm-hmm. and he had sold the bridge back to the county. And while he had owned the bridge, there'd been a 10-cent toll, and after he sold it, the state abolished the toll. Well, this is the 1900s. Word doesn't travel as fast as it would now. Now we would just immediately know on our phones and shit.
Yeah.
So Colonel and his brother stood there and collected the toll for 4 more days.
That's...
until people realized that there was no toll.
I've actually done a little bit of reading too, and one of the funnier grifts that they did, or I guess one of the better ones rather, was that they convinced the world that there was 12 secret herbs and spices. Blow everyone away.
Yeah. And that biscuits can be made ahead of time.
Oh man.
Yeah. Anyway, so he was good looking and he was 23 years old to Kathleen's 15 years old.
Ruh-roh.
And she was very flattered that he took an interest in her, as we mentioned earlier, good personality. he also let her think that he was an army colonel.
Okay.
And remember, this is...
Wait, did you say let her believe?
Yeah.
So then she went, oh, you must be a fancy army colonel. That's why they call you that. And he's just like... Yeah.
Yeah.
An army
colonel.
See?
So this was right between World War I and approaching World War II, so it wasn't out of the ordinary to meet army colonels around.
That's fair.
But he wasn't one. She just believed he was. Mm-hmm. In the spring of 1934, Kathleen learned that she was pregnant. When she told Colonel, he said that he was called away on emergency army business, and he was pretty much never heard from again.
Oh, my God.
Sorry, babe. Gotta go. Emergency. I'm so important.
Something with tanks.
Colonel.
Gotta go.
Colonel, I've worried about telling you, but I think I'm with child. Oh, you... do you hear that?
Congratulations, I've got to go see about some gravy.
This just in, wars are coming. Oh, sorry, babe, gotta go. Wars are coming. Gotta get out of here.
So Kathleen came clean to her mom, Nancy. She didn't hide the pregnancy from her. Nancy said that if Kathleen wanted to stay in her house, she would have to basically stop dancing and rejoin the Nazarene Church.
Stop dancing.
I know. Kathleen agreed temporarily, but she did want out. She didn't want to stay with her mom. She was hoping that Colonel would come back and marry her and they could just live together and be married and she could dance all she wanted and she could dance if she wanted to and she could leave her mom behind. But it became pretty obvious after a while that Colonel wasn't coming back.
No.
The army business was too serious.
Clearly. God, what a dickwad. Anyways.
So Kathleen set her sights on someone else, a man named William Manson. And in August of 1934, they were married. Now, at the time, he was 25 and she lied and claimed to be 21.
And she was...
15.
Wow.
Probably she's still 16 15. At okay. this point.
Wow.
Up until this book, up until the most recent book that I listed in our sources, there was some debate as to whether or not Kathleen had married William Manson before or after she gave birth to Charlie. Mm-hmm. If you ask Charlie, he says that he was born no name Maddox. Maddox was his mother's last name. He claims that she basically was abandoning him from the second he was born. Uh-huh. Legal records show that that's not true. I mean, this is just one of those cases where you're like, yeah, that's Charles Manson being crazy. I find that Charles Manson, in his own words, is very valuable for finding out what Charlie Manson thought of things.
Yeah.
He's not great on facts. But he does provide some fun anecdotes along the way. They may or may not be true. So his mother did get married in August of 1934. And on November 12th, hello. Today is November 12th as well.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Paige.
Yeah, by the time you guys are listening to this. So November 12th, 1934, Charles Mills Manson was born. It's on his birth certificate.
Wait. His middle name was Mills?
M-I-L-L-E-S. It's his grandfather's middle name.
Oh, okay. Mills. Because for a second, I thought that his middle name was Mills. And if his father was Colonel... then he would technically be under that
General Mills. Oh, man.
Oh.
This was confirmed with a birth certificate from Cincinnati General Hospital and his mother's marriage certificate. So there are certificates on file that kind of contradict Charlie's story a little bit. But Kathleen was allegedly a party monster and would often drop Charlie off with Nancy's so that she could go out dancing or drinking without her new husband. At one point, Charlie had an antidote. I don't know if it's true. I can't find any proof for it. Where he said that his mother one time took him out with her to the bars. And the bartender was like, oh, what a cute little boy. I wish I had a cute little boy like that. And then Charlie's mom allegedly sold him for a beer. Allegedly.
What?
Yeah. So essentially, it would be like... if you're like, man, I'd give anything for more mozzarella sticks, and somebody was like, anything? And you were like, here's a baby, and they were like, great.
You know the most insulting part, by the way, is that it was a Natty Ice.
Oh.
I was like, come on, mom, I'm a shock type baby or die.
So William Manson was understandably totally over it, and in April of 1937 he divorced Kathleen. He accused her of, quote, gross neglect of duty.
This time it just gross means like both pretty gross. Like,
ew. Pretty gross.
So 2 weeks before the divorce was final, Kathleen managed to track down Colonel and sued him for child support. Allegedly, he visited Charlie a few times, but he rarely paid the $5 per month in child support. Kathleen ended up getting a total of $25.
Oh, my God.
Jesus Christ.
That's not bad. That's like five footlongs. It's like five footlongs. $5. That's five?
$5 footlongs.
$5 footlong.
Kathleen and Charlie bounced between their grandmother Nancy's house and her older sister Glenna's house until Kathleen got engaged to James Roby, a career criminal. He'd already been convicted of bootlegging and petty theft, but they never actually got married. This is the thing with Charlie's mom. She gets engaged like 12 times and manages to get married like 4 times.
So,
damn.
Kathleen was the one that is known as not being much of a looker, right?
Right. She's got a great personality.
She's got a great personality up until a point, it sounds like.
Personality. Yeah. At some point, people get tired of her.
I feel like she doesn't even have great personality. I feel like she's just walking around and she's like, hey, you're pretty attractive. And she just does like a tap dance. And they're like, that was... I have to marry you.
We're married now, apparently.
Oh, I feel like great personality here is just short for drunk and available and dancing.
Very possible. I mean, at the time, she would have been one of the few women, like, locally that was that drunk and that available. So it's very possible.
She's the... She's the only actual single MILF in your area. Click to learn more.
Oh, gross.
Hot and ready.
She had been working... a few odd jobs, but never really all that much money. And she was tired of constantly being poor and single and trying to provide for Charlie.
Me too, sister.
Yeah, for real. So roughly a year later, she teamed up with her older brother, Luther. And they basically met a man out on the town who seemed to be rich. He had a nice car. He had a whole lot of bills. And so they robbed him. Her brother... yeah, what? Her brother... beat him over the head with a ketchup bottle, knocking him unconscious.
Jesus.
And they stole his car and all of his money, but they didn't plan anything out because the police found them in the car with the money, like, not long after. And the guy woke up and was just like, yeah, it was those people that clubbed me with the ketchup bottle. Like,
the perpetrators are running away in a brown Chevrolet and they are armed with a hot dog.
Her brother Luther claimed that he was the one who had come up with the plan and executed it, so that...
Why would you take credit, dude?
Because his girlfriend was the other girl with them, so that meant that his girlfriend got off, I think, with no jail time.
Okay.
And Kathleen only got 5 years, so he basically took the rap for them.
Oh, I thought he was bragging.
No, he did it so that she wouldn't have to take the full.
Okay.
So during this time, Charlie lived with his Uncle Bill and Aunt Glenna. Charlie was small for his age, and due to his upbringing by his mom, he lied constantly. Mm. He was like a creepy little liar kid, and he was fiercely annoying. They hated having him around. He was obsessed with being the center of attention, even for bad reasons. This is actually something that's really, really, really common with children in bad upbringings, that they're competing so hard for attention because they've been neglected that they'll even take bad attention, just regardless of what they can get. There have actually been scientific experiments where they've actually sat and ignored a child and kind of seen, like, what their response was. Then they went back to the child. It's a
fucked up science experiment.
But it's yeah, a lot of how Jesus. They learned about basically what neglect does to people. And so he's showing signs of some pretty serious neglect. There's also a chance that he might just be a bit of a sociopath, and it might not be a nature versus nurture situation. He may just genetically have been born a sociopath as well. But it's pretty clear he's got a lot of sociopathic tendencies.
Well, and there's also like a perfect storm of like, well, if your mom's a sociopath, that's cool with just dancing all night, neglecting you, selling right. you for a beer. Like, your chances aren't great that you're not a sociopath.
She does kind of clean up her act later. We'll get to it. I don't know that she's a sociopath. I think she was just a sheltered child that fell on kind of hard times and then didn't really know how to manage it. Mm. Because later on, she does kind of clean up her act. But at a certain point, she all but disowns Charlie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I would too, for sure.
Well, we'll get to it, because, yeah, we'll get to when and where she actually does. So he started school with a legendary bad first grade teacher. So there's actually records of other people who had this first grade teacher, and they're like, she was fucking brutal. That woman was evil, and he just happened to have her. Her name was Mrs. Varner. She's like... known in the school district as being like a horribly abusive, horrible woman.
Jesus. Yeah, and that's when you could hit kids in school.
And
so.
She 100% did. She put Charlie in the back of the room and basically berated him all day. And so Charlie ran home crying, which, by the way, who's five at the time.
I just see
walked the school as a five-year-old.
I know that he didn't look like he did at the end always, no, but I just imagine long-haired Charlie running home going, it's just so funny.
His uncle didn't like that he was crying. He didn't think boys should cry. Ever. Aww. So in order to teach Charlie not to cry like a sissy, his Uncle Bill dressed him like a girl for school the next day.
Oh.
Jesus Christ.
Which, of course, set him up for success perfectly. No. Charlie didn't have a ton of friends because they thought he was weird. He was also an instigator, and he loved to start shit and let others finish it. So he was a big fan of, like, starting playground fights and then backing out and letting other people duke it out. Like, letting people come to his defense and then being like, oh, I don't know what happened. Just, like, letting people fight for his amusement. He became obsessed with knives, swords, and guns. But most importantly, he was obsessed with the piano that his aunt and uncle had in their house. He used to play it all the time by ear.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I just imagined him playing it with knives.
Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah, it's just like... Edward Scissorhanding with knives and guns.
He would lose himself singing and playing. It was the only way they could get him to go to church was to promise that he would be allowed to sing, basically.
Okay.
So he loved music even from childhood. After spending 3 years as a model prisoner, Kathleen was released on good behavior. She pulled Charlie out of Glenna's house, and he claimed that these were the happiest years of his life living with his mom. Aww. After.
After, because she the robbery with the ketchup bottle.
Exactly.
Right. So she was a model prisoner. Was that Vogue, or was that...
Cosmo.
It was Great Personality Monthly.
It was Paper Bag Digest.
Oh.
So as a child, Charlie was manipulative. But he was particularly good at manipulating women. Where his mom worked at a grocery store for a while, she tried to get an honest job, and he would run away from school and ask her for candy, and when she would say no, he would manage to get enough money from all the other women in the store to just buy candy. Because he could get money. He would easily manipulate people. He was a cute kid. He was small, so he looked younger than he was.
Hey, everybody, this is Charles, man. Thanks for coming to my Patreon page. I am trying to buy candy. Your donation really helps.
You didn't
helps.
Give me my Kickstarter for Hella Funyuns.
I am a big fan of Lil Yachty's Hot Chase Ride.
So for the next 4 years, Charlie and Kathleen drifted from city to city. According to Charlie, at this time, she may have been a sex worker. He disagrees, even within his own story, where he's like, yeah, sometimes she would sell her body to people, but not always. And like, okay, well, she people paid her for sex occasionally?
Yeah.
That'd be a sex worker.
No, because she didn't do it all the time.
So she's a part-time sex worker?
No, she didn't do sex work.
Well, and that's the thing. There's no other proof that she did sex work. Because here's the thing. She wasn't good at crime. She would constantly get caught whenever she tried to pull off crimes.
Oh, yeah.
So it's pretty unlikely that for 4 years, she managed to be a sex worker completely undetected.
I just like his thought process of like, no, man, like a mailman, right?
Like, a mailman go home, he's still a mailman. But my mom, when she clocked out, she was just mommy again. At work, she was mommy with an I, but at home, she was mommy with a Y.
What I think is probably more likely is that she was just trying to find a new husband.
Oh,
that
yeah.
seems to be kind of a theme with her, was not necessarily that she would ever want to... that was, in her mind, the best way to make money.
Was to be married. Okay.
You know, she wasn't opposed to work. She would work. But in her mind, the best opportunity for money was to marry someone who could take care of her.
I'm also just boggled by, like, I don't know if that's how you use the term boggled.
Yeah.
I am perplexed with the that's a winning word in boggle with the idea of how many places just let her bring Charlie to, like,
around
the
yeah.
bar. Like, he was just in the bar. Mm-hmm. Like, whether or not that story of being sold is true, he was in the bar, And then, like, at the grocery store job, just hanging out.
Just hanging out. Well, and he was, like, a creepy little pickpocket kid who just constantly stole.
Oh, yeah.
And so nobody wanted Charlie around. So I strongly suspect that she maybe wasn't a sex worker and was just actively trying to date people. And Charlie was scaring them away. That's yeah. kind of what I suspect. So in 1943, she joined Alcoholics Anonymous, where she met a circus worker named Lewis. Now, he actually did work in the circus. By the way, I just want to say, no value judgment on sex work at all. I was just trying to get accurate facts as far
previous. For sure. I'm more so laughing at the fact, just the statement. She went to AA, where she met a carnival worker.
She met a carny named Lewis.
I'm gonna better my life. I'm gonna go to AA and meet a carny.
They were married that summer.
Oh, God.
Yikes.
Now, here was kind of the one thing. So, she previously would target older, richer men because mm-hmm. she wanted them to take care of her. Lewis was kind of the exception. They were kind of both in the shit together, and he didn't really have any money. So, it's one of those things that I kind of feel like maybe they actually loved each other, and they stayed together for quite a long time compared to her previous relationships. Kathleen actually at this point managed to get her drinking under control.
Yay!
So at that point, she got sober. Lewis didn't, and he became almost as big of a problem as Charlie.
Okay. Oh, no.
So this is husband number four?
This is husband number three.
Number three.
There was an engagement.
Oh, okay. Fourth engagement.
So this is fourth engagement, third husband.
Okay. All right. So she's got the same symptoms that run in her family where it's like it feels like a cold and she was married within the week.
Hey.
So Charlie had begun stealing things at any chance, at home, at work, wherever he could get a hand on them.
Who steals from home? Oh, that looks good. I'm going to take it. Yeah. Well, now I'm going to put it in my home and just put it back.
Think about this. They were moving from house to house where sometimes he would stay with Nancy. Sometimes he would stay with Glenn. At one point, he tries to steal a gun from his uncle, Bill and Aunt Glenna.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just, you couldn't trust him in a room. He would just steal shit for the fun of it.
No, just steal little bites of food of your roommate's food. All right. That's what you do.
So he also started to scream at his mother frequently, who claimed that he scared her with his crazy eyes.
Oh, my God.
So they were there from the beginning. So she's got a little weird crazy-eyed kid.
Oh, you can see it in that picture.
He has a terrifying smile.
Yeah.
I also just like the thought that Charles Manson is just like every ungrateful white son, where at one point in his teenage years was like, fuck you, Kathleen.
Then I'll get to it slightly later. So in 1947, she surrendered 12-year-old Charlie to the Gibault School for Boys. Part of the reason she did this is because she had gotten sober and she was trying to get Lewis, her husband, to become sober.
Okay.
And Charlie was just a tornado of terrifying badness the entire time. And he was way too much for her to handle. And she felt like no matter what she did, it didn't improve his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not shocking. He's a sociopath. He does not care.
Plus, I bet she tried everything, like hitting him and dancing at him.
She actually didn't typically hit him. She would occasionally send him to his grandmother, who also didn't hit him.
Okay.
From what?
Do you have any records of any dance battles that happened between the two of them?
No, actually. Oh. I wish I did.
Unfortunate.
He did get served with some jail time later.
Oh, all right.
But it seems like, with the exception of Uncle Bill and Aunt Glenna, his mother and grandmother were fairly kind
mm-hmm.
to him in trying to correct his behavior, and he was just a terror, is okay. what it sounds like. So she surrendered him to a boys' school 75 miles away in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. It was a school for male delinquents, but it was run by Catholic priests.
That's a rough mix.
Yeah, we'll
get
to it.
Not good.
There were roughly 125 students at the time. They served boys from 5th to 10th grade. Students were required to attend Catholic services, but this school actually isn't the worst of the ones he goes to. They offered shop classes, academic classes, and a farm where students could work, learn trades, and grow fresh vegetables for them to eat at the school. And by all accounts, it was pleasant, allegedly, but Charlie hated it.
That means it probably was pleasant.
Yeah, he ran away multiple times. He claims that he was repeatedly beaten. Given the time period and the type of school, he probably was beaten at least once. They mm-hmm. did spank, essentially, at the school.
Okay.
But he constantly ran away, finally ending up in Indianapolis at about, he's roughly 13 at this point, and mm-hmm. he robbed enough stores to pay for a small apartment.
What?
Damn, so what?
At 13, he's living on his own in Indianapolis with money that he earned by robbing local stores.
First of all, earned is a strong word to use a robbery.
You know,
secondly,
he's 13.
I can't even work a job well enough to get a small apartment in Los Angeles.
Right.
Yeah, it's insane.
It's crazy. I also love that he's a street kid and his first thought is apartment. Like, not like candy. Like, he's actually thinking ahead of, like, I need a place to stay. Like, it's, to me, it's kind of shocking how advanced he seems at certain points.
Yeah. Actually, surprisingly, it was 50-50. I got the apartment because I was like, think of how much extra candy space I could put here.
He was finally caught stealing, which made him the court's responsibility, because previously his mother had surrendered him, but now the court got to decide where he went.
And this was at what age?
He was about 13.
13? All right.
He was sentenced to Boys Town, a famous juvenile facility. Not the one from the 80s.
No, I know. It's just... Boys Town sounds cool.
It's colloquial now. Yeah.
It sounds like a real cool place. Welcome to Boys Town, where we have Mud Village and so much porn. See, just so much pornography.
I was thinking it was more like, welcome to Boys Town. Go-go nights are Thursdays. Like, that's how I was thinking about it. But yeah. So
I was just trying to think about what actual boys would have. It was like dirt and just...
Dirt,
gross.
So much porn.
Gross.
Wet towels.
Tombstone pizzas.
No, they dry. Oh, God, do they dry.
Oh, no.
Oh, anyway. So crusty.
So he was sent to Boys Town. Boys Town was actually famous. There was a movie starring Mickey Rooney mm-hmm. about Boys Town.
Okay.
4 days later, he escaped with a fellow inmate by stealing a car and a gun and driving to Peoria, Illinois. They committed 2 armed robberies along the way.
I've been to both Terre Haute and Peoria. Brap, brap.
That cheese dairy belt.
That was a direct quote from Charles Manson. Brap, brap. I've been to both of those places. Brap, brap.
Brap, brap. He was caught about 2 weeks later, and given the escalation of his crimes, and because they technically committed armed robbery, he was sentenced to the Indiana Boys School, which was more prison than school.
Okay.
And if his initial upbringing with somewhat absentee mother hadn't messed Charlie up enough, the Indiana Boys School definitely finished the job.
Yeah, because this is where you're getting into, like, they're almost just, like, unnamed juvenile detention centers is really
right.
What they
are. And especially at this time in history, it fared way worse.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, inmates at the boys' school ranged from the ages of 10 to 21. At 14, Charlie was on the younger end.
When are you no longer a boy?
Yeah. Well, and Charlie was also, again, small for his age. So, he was probably closer in size to the boys who were 10 or 11, even though he was 14. Boys would receive whatever level of physical correction the guards deemed necessary, including beatings and torture. A procedure called duck walking was common, which is where they would tie the boys' wrists to their ankles and make them walk short distances.
I don't think they've ever seen a duck before.
Yeah, it's I don't know why it's called duck walking.
You'd have
maybe
to
because
hop.
You kind of waddle.
I guess.
But worse than that was something called table bending, which was an incredibly painful practice in which guards would hold a boy steady and then arch his back over and across a table so that his shoulder blades barely touched while his feet stayed stationary. When released from this position, boys often could not walk for a few hours.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's literally torture, and these are children. Yeah.
Except for the 21-year-old boys.
Right.
Because that's just a grown man going, I'm a boy. Welcome to Boy Town.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing that's scary about these places is you basically have grown men and children together and they're all...
It comes up. Yeah. There's a weird thing about, like, even high school. When you get into high school, you're like a 13, 14-year-old, like, barely a teenager. And by the time, like, take me, for example. In, like, when I entered into high school, I was, like, 5'11" or something. 4 years later, after getting into high school, I was 6'4".
Yeah.
And just a massive person going to school with 14-year-old kids. Just being like, move out of my way, twerp. Papa's gotta buy a cookie.
So Charlie arrived at the Indiana Boys School in 1949 at the age of 14. Because, as we mentioned, he was small for his age and younger, he was repeatedly raped and forced into sexual acts by the older boys. As a result, he literally until the end of his life had a very detached view of rape in general and claimed that it didn't affect him at all. He was raped so often, allegedly,
that he dissociated from it
and basically was like, yeah, you just walk that shit off.
That's horrible.
Yeah. Are there mentions either from his side or later on in history, maybe it's something we look into, about like, is there sexual abuse coming from the guards and the
allegedly leaders? According to him, there's a story of a guard instructing other inmates to sodomize him.
Oh, that's fucked up.
Yeah, that's the only mention of it I could find. And again, a lot of this comes from Manson in his own words, mm-hmm. where he waffles back and forth, where he's like, I was never raped. I mean, I'd fuck a punk, but, like, that's it. Yeah. Like, you know, he doesn't really go into it. I would say, based on records from other people at the time and the few things that he has mentioned, he was raped, and he was raped a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
And of course, Charles Manson is a terrible person, but no one should be raped ever.
Right, of course. And this is also taking somebody who was a problem child and just...
Oh, making it so much worse. Adding...
Fired gasoline. Like,
well, just adding, just, like, trauma. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yes. Yeah. This was bad. And there are other schools like this at the same time where people were reporting the same. Mm. So I think it's fairly safe to say it was bad. It was real bad.
Yeah, I hated school because they were like, hey, please don't be on your phone so much. So, you know.
Right. At the age of 14, he was barely literate, having skipped so much school as a child that he pretty much couldn't read. And this actually went through the rest of his life. He didn't really learn to competently read until much later.
All right.
And even then, he struggled. He may have had a learning disability, but no one was testing for those at the time.
Learning disability, like...
ADHD, I would suspect.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought you meant, like...
Or dyslexia.
Like dyslexia, yeah.
He may have, because he does continue to struggle to read, so that's very possible. He learned, at this point, that whenever he was threatened, it was easier for him to act insane.
Okay.
Which we see a lot of later on in his life. Yeah. That becomes kind of a theme. And a lot of the things that they describe, he said, like, making weird facial, you know, gestures, pulling at your hair, screaming, saying nonsense phrases. And I'm like, yeah, that's what we see from him later on. It's a defense mechanism, clearly. So
he would often say insane phrases like, you got spiders for brains.
Spiders in your brain.
Or Arby's is good. You know, just the craziest sentences.
Insane. So 2 years later, Charlie escaped yet again and was caught yet again. He was then transferred to the National Training School for Boys in Washington, D.C. Now,
is there a reason they keep moving him around? Like, every time he gets caught? Is this because they're like, oh, you already found the way out.
Yes.
We're not gonna, okay.
Yeah, it's A, because he keeps escaping, and B, at a certain point later on, they decide that he is too dangerous for Gen Pop.
Okay. So that's when they just stop putting you in school and start putting you in real prison.
Basically, yeah. Okay. So, at the National Training School for Boys, there wasn't necessarily as much rape like, there aren't as many stories about it at this point.
Okay.
The National School for Boys was very regimented and was actually a school, and you weren't allowed to leave classes. It was like a prison school, essentially. At this point, they gave Charlie his first IQ test. He'd scored at 109. Now, he still can't really read, but 109 is the higher end of average.
Yeah. And it's way above what I scored when I went and took one at the Scientology
Center. I'm pretty sure
that
was fake, dude.
That's not real at all.
There's no way that was real.
Hey, you tell me. Me think real.
Well, and something to note about IQ tests, and it'll come up a little bit later too, they're a little subjective because they only test for certain types of intelligence, and you can improve your IQ. A lot of people don't realize that. It doesn't necessarily equate to school smarts, as we see here. He can't read, and he's still scoring 109.
Yeah.
So it's highly regimented, but he eventually secured a transfer to a lower security facility for good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
His aunt and uncle attempted to secure his release and promised they could live with him. However, just before he was about to be released, Charlie was caught forcibly sodomizing another boy at knife point.
Ooh.
He claims the act was consensual and that the other boy wanted it. But it doesn't really matter because at the time, consensual homosexual intercourse
is illegal.
Was just as much of a crime as forcible rape.
Also, how do you fucking explain away that knife? Like, no, he's into it. He likes knives. He's a knife guy. He's a nice guy who's a knife guy.
Yeah. So, was grounds for transfer to an even stricter facility.
Oh, man.
Knife guys finish last.
So, in his first 6 months...
Knife guys finish slashed.
Oh!
So, in his first 6 months at the more strict facility, he committed 8 infractions, 3 of them being homosexual in nature. So he was pretty fond of raping other prisoners.
Oh, God.
Likely to show dominance because he was a tiny dude. So it was his way to kind of scare people away from him, I would imagine. He was considered too dangerous for the general population of the prison. Not like general population of Earth.
Yeah.
Of the prison. And he was transferred to a maximum security facility. He was deemed incapable of release into society until November 12th, 1955.
His birthday?
When Charlie turned 21.
What? They're like, you're too dangerous?
Yeah, it carries law, 10 to 21.
By law, he had to be released.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, Charlie mostly lived with Nancy, his grandmother, and he found work at the Wheeling Downs racetrack. Actually, lawful work. He seemed to be relatively on the straight and narrow.
The sketchy side of lawful work. It's still
traveling. Yeah, true. He made a lot of friends with the local pimps in the area. He was fascinated with pimps and pimping and how to make women subservient to you. It was very...
Yeah, I get it. We've all listened to 50 Cent's music. I don't know what you heard about me.
He struggled to make friends because most of the people his age in town had known each other their entire lives. His grandmother had since moved closer to his aunt.
Oh yeah, that's why he struggled to have friends.
I'm sure it was also right because he was a creepy weirdo.
It wasn't the crazy eyes or the knife
and the shouting
and the
knives. But no, most of the people there had known each other their whole lives. He was kind of an outsider. It was very cliquey. He struggled to find anyone to hang out with. And loneliness is never good for somebody like that.
No.
So that's when he befriended most of the pimps outside the racetrack.
Damn.
At his grandmother's request, as a condition of living with his grandmother, at her request, he attended the Nazarene church every Sunday. Charlie was great at recalling scripture, but would often manipulate it for his own use. Nancy also insisted that he join the youth group, but they weren't very welcoming because, obviously...
He's a criminal. Yeah,
all that
they're
raping.
All upstanding...
Members
of society.
Hey, I have a question. The Nazarene is the faith that his grandmother's a part of.
Mm-hmm.
So they're against frivolous things like dancing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How did they feel about like music and singing in the churches?
Singing is okay. Dancing is not.
Okay. So he still probably got to sing at these.
Yeah, he got to sing a lot.
All right. I just didn't know because like if you said his favorite part was the singing and then they were like, hey, we don't do that frivolous shit. No singing. No. I feel like he would have been like,
Singing is a part of most churches. I don't think I've ever encountered a church where there wasn't singing. dancing less so, because the idea is that you'd be moving your body next to a person of the opposite gender, not leaving room for the Holy Spirit.
All right, that makes more sense.
Yeah. So they weren't very welcoming. He didn't really make any friends. So he retreated to his cousin Joanna's house. Joanna, by this time, had grown up and married a minister. He arrived at her house one day to find the minister talking to teenage girls in their house. They were, like, having an event at their house. There were a lot of teenage girls. And Charlie immediately zeroed in on the teenage girls and immediately had them eating out of his fingers. And Joe and her husband basically kicked him out of the house because they thought he was too dangerous to be around the teenage girls.
Oh, my God.
Yikes.
Yeah. He immediately had their attention that quickly. He was that easily manipulative, and he could easily get young girls on his side, which will come into play a lot later.
Yeah.
So he was straight, despite pretty much all of his sexual interactions previously being homosexual. He considers himself straight.
Okay. All right. So he identifies as straight.
He identifies as straight. There's definitely some experimentation later on, but it's usually taking, not giving, and at other people's requests. He couldn't afford sex workers, and none of the local girls would date him. So a local man at...
Because he was friends with their boss.
Yeah, pretty much.
Could you imagine? Just like your friend, like you work at a grocery store and your manager's friend comes over and he's like, hey, what's up, hot stuff?
Yeah.
Yikes.
So a local gambler that used to frequent the track a lot made friends with Charlie. He was a little bit older. He actually had teenage daughters himself. And he made the mistake of introducing Charlie to his daughters, his middle daughter, Rosalie. They immediately went steady, and months later, they were married. Everyone assumed Rosalie was pregnant, and they used to actually say about her that the baby came early and the wedding came late. They thought it was a shotgun wedding, but she never had a baby. She either wasn't pregnant or miscarried, whatever.
How old is she?
17.
17, and he was 20?
21.
21.
It's right. Not that creepy.
Was that within great, the statutes of the law where they were?
Oh, yeah. At the time, that was wildly normal.
Okay.
And even, I mean, this sounds terrible. You could, in theory, have, like, met as a senior and freshman in high school.
Yeah.
And married at 17 and 21.
It's conceivable. It's still not a great idea. Exactly. But it's
conceivable. Charlie at this point actually seemed to act pretty normal for a while. Rosalie eventually did become pregnant. Charlie started stealing cars for extra money.
Oh, I just like that period where you said he was relatively normal. So I just figured that somebody would come up to him and be like, hey, what's your name? And he'd be like, me? My name's... Charles Manson. Nice to meet you.
Apparently later in life, he requested to go by Charles, and his friends in prison called him Charles. So unfortunately, once he found out that Rosalie was pregnant, doctor's appointments and things start adding up, and his salary couldn't cover the cost. So he started stealing cars.
Okay. And this is why we need health care for everyone, right?
Agreed, actually.
I'm Charles Manson, and I approve this message.
And, I mean, it is... Now, granted, I would argue that he was a lifelong criminal and would have eventually probably gone back to crime. But in theory, if he had not had to steal that extra money... Maybe we wouldn't have a Manson family. Probably. Maybe. We probably still would. So he started stealing cars for extra money, but the heat was on locally, and fearing ending up in jail again because he didn't want another conviction on his record, he stole a car, and he and Rosalie drove a stolen car across the country out west to California to visit his mother, Kathleen, who had relocated there.
Oh, my God. Is she still married to Lewis?
She's still married to Lewis at that point. Now, she and Lewis had been kind of like on and off, but mostly on.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like, they have their differences, but they're in it to win it together, and they're trying to stick together. So once they got to California, it took them just a couple days, and a cop discovered the stolen plates on the car. And Charlie was arrested, this time as an adult.
Yep, that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. He requested lenience to see his son born, but he was still sentenced to 3 years in San Pedro's Terminal Island Penitentiary in the L.A. Harbor. While in prison, Rosalie gave birth to Charles Manson Jr. She left Charlie for another man, taking Charlie Jr. with her. Unfortunately, Charles Jr. committed suicide in 1993.
Oh my God.
He had long since changed his name to Charles White, but knowing his real father's identity troubled him so greatly that it's thought to be the reason he killed himself.
Oh shit.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hardcore.
That's terrifying to like see yeah. that as a piece of yourself.
Yeah. Well, and allegedly that's what it was, is that he was like, this is in me somewhere.
It's probably, scary.
Yeah.
Probably within the spiders in your brain.
Spiders. So Charlie admitted to prison again, now scored 121 on IQ tests. So he's okay. getting smarter.
this is like
it's getting smarter.
but he still struggled to read, but his problem solving skills have gotten better. We'll see this kind of grow as he stays in prison. In prison, they offered him a lot of options for vocational classes, etc. He chose not to take any of them, but instead became obsessed with the Dale Carnegie course on how to win friends and influence people. Oh my
fucking Christ.
So now, if you've been with Cult Podcast from the beginning, you may remember the Dale Carnegie course from Lost episode number 17, yeah. where we talked about large group awareness training. Just a primer, because those episodes have been lost for a while and we legally can't release them again yet. The Dale Carnegie course was essentially a course on manipulating people into liking you. And it basically gave him the tools to continually manipulate people. So he didn't finish the Dale Carnegie course. He basically took what he could learn from it and then was like, I got it, I'm done. And then stopped taking courses. But he made a ton of pimp friends in jail. More fuck? And more pimp friends. He was obsessed with being a pimp. Obsessed with having like a group of girls follow him. Which again, it's gonna come back.
Yeah.
And 1958, September 30th, Charlie was released into the care of his mother on good behavior. So he didn't actually finish out his entire sentence. He only served about 7 years of a 10-year sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Instead
he gave old Charlie the good boy deal.
Yeah. Instead of getting a regular job, he became a pimp. No surprise there.
No, not at all.
Until he was discovered forging checks. One of his girls, Leona, who he later married to try and get out of being convicted for forging checks, she claimed to be pregnant to plead for leniency, but just like the first time, didn't really work. It gave them some time for an appeal, but it ultimately failed.
Leona, the cops is coming. Quick, we gotta fuck right
quick,
now.
Quick, quick, make a baby. In 1961, he was sentenced to 10 years in McNeil Prison on Puget Sound. Kathleen moved to be close to him and reconciled with Lewis in the process. So she and Lewis are now back together, going strong. And they adopted a baby girl.
They adopted?
Yes.
Okay.
They adopted a baby girl. They wanted to try and undo the mess they had made with Charlie.
Okay.
Now, this baby girl is important because at one point, Charlie would basically just ask his mother to bring things to prison for him. He would never ask her how she was doing. He just needed her for stuff. And at one point, he asked her for a new guitar or money for a new guitar. And she said that she couldn't afford it. And then she brought his new baby sister a month or two later. And he was like, how much did she cost you? And his mother was like, $2,000. And he was like, but you said you couldn't afford the guitar. So that was the last time Charlie ever saw his half-sister, mm-hmm. adopted sister.
Oh, wow.
The last time he ever saw her, they couldn't bring her near him because he would go into a rage. Like, hardcore. The rest of the time that Kathleen was visiting him in prison, they would make her wait in the car. Her name is Nancy, by the way. She was named after her grandmother.
Mm. Damn, that poor girl.
Yeah. there were many religious groups in the prison, Hermeticists, born-again Christians, but most notable and the one that attracted Charlie the most was a new group based on a novel called Dianetics.
Never heard of it.
Prison records say that Scientology actually seemed to help Charlie. He talked about it all the time. He claimed that he thought Scientology would enable him to do whatever he wanted.
Okay.
Which, you know, that's kind of how Scientology is, where it's just like, you can achieve anything as long as, you know, you clear yourself of Thetans or whatever. So Leona, the woman who claimed to have Charlie's baby, divorced him while he was still in prison shortly after giving birth to Charles Luther Manson, Charlie's second son, in 1964. So there's two Charlie Juniors. They're both
Charlies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not surprised there.
No.
And so one of them has passed away.
What is he
away.
Trying to fucking... oh, what's his name? He's trying to George Foreman.
George Foreman.
Yeah.
There are
this
no...
is my son, George Foreman, and my other son George Foreman, and my grill, George Foreman.
There's no real further records of Charlie's second son. No one really knows what happened to him.
Oh, wow.
While in prison, Charlie befriended a man named Alvin Creepy Karpus.
What? I'm sorry, what?
Alvin Creepy Karpus.
Oh.
Creepy's a nickname.
But Karpus is a real name?
Karpus is his last name.
That's creepier than being creepy.
So Alvin Creepy Karpus was a member of the Barker Gang in the 1930s. Famous for robbing banks, etc.
And howling in the moon.
Howling for bacon strips.
Bacon for bacon.
It's real bacon.
It's bacon! Originally imprisoned in Alcatraz in 1936, Alvin was transferred to McNeil Prison in 1962, a year after Charlie, when Alcatraz closed. Charlie befriended Karpus because he was an accomplished steel guitar player. And he also told Charlie about Stranger in a Strange Land, which was a famous book at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But Charlie's reading struggles prevented him from reading it. So he basically just went on what people told him about it. It's pretty anti-establishment, very kind of disenfranchised. It's interesting. It's an idea that the government is not on your side, which Charlie definitely identifies with. And that you are alone in a sea of people who are not having your best interests at heart. Again, something Charlie very much identifies with.
It's also how it feels as a poor person.
Yeah, like
that's the idea of the book, yeah. Essentially. So, even though he couldn't read it, he added it basically to his lexicon. This, Dale Carnegie and Dianetics would be the building blocks for his religion later on.
Don't forget my other one. Clifford the Big Red Dog. Yeah. That one book, Clifford Got a Doom Buggy? Man, that was my shit.
While very little news made it into the prison, they did have radio. And in 1964, the number one hit on the charts was Unescapable.
Oh, yeah. Tell you something, I think you'll understand when I say that something. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh, please say to me.
Charlie was kind of ambivalent about the Beatles' music itself. But he was very enticed by their fame because even he had heard of them in prison. He decided that he wanted the same level of fame, and he constantly spent time with his guitar trying to write his own songs. He was proud of them, but the lyrics were rudimentary at best, but the prison would let him play shows all the time, so he became pretty accomplished as far as skills go.
As far as prisoners go, too.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, really. It became his new obsession. And surprisingly, it kept him out of trouble. For the next few years in prison, he had no infractions. They had no problems with him. Kathleen, his mother, remarried. And at that point, she pretty much never saw Charlie again. So this is where he actually kind of gets abandoned. She kind of writes him out of her life. And doesn't really encounter him again until much later after.
Well, it sounds like he just used her, and then she was kind of terrified of him anyway.
Yes.
So it's
I would agree with you. Mm-hmm.
I get that.
Due to prison overcrowding in March of 1967, Charlie was released. He didn't want to leave prison, but they released him. His final prison report said, "He has a pattern of criminal behavior and confinement that date to his teen years. Little can be expected in the way of change in his attitude and behavior or mode of conduct." And on the advice of a former inmate, Charlie relocated to Berkeley, California, right in the middle of the counterculture movement. And that's where we will leave you today.
Dun, dun, dun!
Dun, dun, dun!
That's why I always say, go Golden Bears.
So Charlie, who had been incarcerated for 14 of his 20-something odd years at that point,
Jesus,
was now plopped down into a society that he was unfamiliar with and did not understand. Because when you think about it, I mean, we talk about people who've been, like, in cults for 14 years or, like, imprisoned in a weird house school for, like, 14 years, and how will they reintegrate into society? In a way, that's what happened to Charlie, too. It was just prison.
Yeah, it's famously hard for prisoners to reacclimate to our society because we... Yeah. Like, there's a huge stigma. Like, it's hard... Now, especially, it's hard to get jobs.
Yeah. Well, not just a stigma, but also just a lifestyle. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way that... Because prisoners are... The way that they're regulated and the way that they're treated while in prison and just the culture of prison and all the things you have to worry about that you just don't have to worry about, it leaves a lot of people with PTSD.
Yeah.
Like, even people who went to prison and were innocent come back and then they have a difficult time, even though they're cleared,
right,
reintegrating just because of the PTSD of prison.
Yeah, yeah. It's messed up.
There's something like a huge amount of people who are arrested just start a cycle of being incarcerated again and again.
It's pretty common.
Yeah.
Even if their first arrest is for a minor infraction, a lot of times instead of reintegrating into society and leaving crime, they actually just learn more about crime while they're in prison, mm-hmm. and then it becomes their only way to survive because they can't get a real job when they get
well,
out.
Well, here's what, and I heard, it was very interesting. I heard someone explain it to me like this. You commit a mild infraction. Mm-hmm. Maybe you spend the weekend in jail. But you're in jail, you lose your job because you just don't show up.
Yeah.
So now you don't have a job, but now you're trying to get a job with a jail sentence or with anything on your record. Good luck. So you can't find a job. The only way for you to make money, you turn to crime, which lands you in jail again. And it is a pretty vicious cycle.
It's horrible.
It happens to a lot of people that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So don't end up in prison the first time if you can help it.
Well, yeah. That's the issue too, though, is like, if you're a person of color, you're more likely to end up in jail for minor offenses.
That is true.
So that's...
Statistically,
I mean, there's all these things that happen, and poor people, because they can't afford bail, can sit in prison longer. They're more likely to lose their job.
That's true. Even if you are innocent, if you cannot post bail, you will sit in jail the entire time.
Yeah, and you can still lose your job, or you can still, you know, lose income. It's mm-hmm. just an incredibly unfair system.
Yeah.
This has been our new segment called Prison with Two White Women.
Anyway, so that's Charles Manson week one. We've got three more episodes coming up. One of them will include a deep dive into the Beatles' White Album.
Ooh, neat.
Yeah.
As necessary. And we're hoping to have some special guests and stuff as well, and some more sources for you coming up.
A very Manson-y Thanksgiving.
It's a very Manson-y Thanksgiving. We thought it was only fitting to start on his birthday and then take it where it goes.
And happy birthday, Paige.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy birthday, Paige.
Thank you. So far, I've received a cookbook and a gravy boat, and I'm very excited.
Yay!
I've got weird adult presents, and I'm so happy.
Yeah. Every year for Christmas now, somebody will get me a pair of socks, and I almost cry in gratitude.
You're just like, thank you.
Yeah, and if you want to hear me talk in more funny voices and do stupid things, then you can check me out on social media, Twitter and Instagram, @MondoDoesStuff, M-A-N-D-O, does stuff.
And if you want to send me more books on Manson to fill out my collection, or, I don't know, send me pictures of people that aren't great looking but have a good personality, you can do that at Paige Wesley on Twitter and at Rampage Wesley on Instagram.
And if you want to talk about the prison industrial complex with a white woman... you can get at me at Sundress Comic on all the things, or if you want to come to my show, I have a show this Wednesday at Flappers at 9:30. Something about booze and bootlegging. I don't know if I have to wear a costume or what's going on, but...
Oh, and that's right. If you're listening to this on Monday, then in 2 days, I'm on the Cookies and Sweatpants show, or I'm on Roast Battle on the 13th.
Hell yeah, dude.
Hell yeah. So feel free to come out to either one of those if you would like.
Yay!
There you go. And if you want to follow the show, you can do so on Instagram @ColePodcast.
on Twitter at Cult Podcast Show.
You can also send us an email with something like a cult recommendation, a book recommendation, or the legally binding electronic document that transfers your soul over to us.
Great.
You can send that via PDF to our email, Cult Podcast Show.
Please make sure it's a signable PDF.
Yeah. You're gonna wanna use the font that's just called Blood, and it is your actual blood. And you can send that to cultpodcastshow@gmail.com.
And if you want to send us a box of spiders, you can do that.
No.
That has happened to me.
Or taxidermy. I'm a big fan of taxidermy.
Ooh, yes.
Or a box of spiders.
Oh, no.
You can send it to 3756 West Avenue 40, Suite K, number 237.
Like the Shining.
Los Angeles, California, 90065.
You can also find more information about the show, as well as a weekly blog post in the new, I think we're calling it the Speculation Zone. Is
that
sticking?
I think so.
Yeah, that's a new name. You can find a weekly blog post there at cultpodcastshow.com.
Yay!
Yay!
And I'm going to call this one, Don't Drink Alcohol and Leave Your Baby with a Bartender.
Yikes.
And Don't Drink the Kool-Aid.
Bye!
Bye! Bye.
Hey, bartender, you got change for this baby?